Okay, week two. Every time I stand up here, I'm reminded very strongly that I'm a big fat introvert. All right, I announced last week that session two was going to be called Galileo Was an Idiot. But sometime between then and now, I've gotten religion or humility or something. I've changed it to the Galileo Affair. But if you want to still call it Galileo Was an Idiot, Rob, we can go with that. Okay? We'll judge together at the end. So, quick review of last week. Last week we talked about two main points. The second one that we talked about was called the conflict thesis or the warfare model. And that was that the dominant view that we all grew up with, that permeates our society, of the relationship between science and faith is warfare or conflict. The scientists are always trying to push God out of life, and religious people are always trying to hold science back. And it just depends on which side of that divide you're on as to which view you hold. Well, what we studied last week was that that model was a fabrication. It was made up. It was made up in the late 1800s by two men, a man named Draper and a man named Andrew Dixon White on the right, who founded Cornell University. And we talked about some of the reasons why they did that, and we looked at the books that they wrote that caused all this misinformation to be part of what we've taught ourselves and our children for 130 years. And we talked a little bit about the flat earth model, how if you're like me, and you probably are in this regard, you grew up thinking that through the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages all the way up to Columbus, the dominant view that everyone had was that the world was flat. And it took Columbus to prove that it was not, that it was round, spherical. But the reality was that all through those times, beginning to end, the dominant view really was that the earth was a sphere. And there were a couple of guys that held out that it was flat. And those were the guys that these two men that we looked at a minute ago highlighted in their book to make us think that that was the dominant position and that we were holding back science all that time. We talked a little bit about Mr. White or Dr. White's book and how he quoted a book by Washington Irving on Christopher Columbus. And from that, we got the idea, mistakenly, that the council at Salamanca, who was arguing with Columbus, was telling him that the earth was flat. And he was saying, no, it's a sphere and I can get to Asia. Well, what in reality they were arguing about was that the council at Salamanca was saying, your calculation for the circumference of the earth is way too small and you can't hold enough food to get to Asia on those boats. And they were right. There was no way he could get to Asia on those boats with enough food. It was lucky that America was in between Europe and Asia. He had a stopping point on the way, and he thought it was Asia, if you remember. He thought he landed in the Indies, the East Indies, but he was in the West Indies. So the other thing that we talked about last week, just a quick review, is this idea that all of us are always working to understand what's around us. And God is one of those things that we're trying to understand. We're trying to figure out how we relate and what we're supposed to do and what he's trying to do. And we walk around and we have understanding of some little piece, and it's represented by the thimble up here. The thimble is what we understand. And every now and then, our cup gets a little larger, and we talked about a communion cup and a Dixie cup and a solo cup. But the thing that we tend to forget is that God is the ocean. And no matter how big our cup of understanding is, God's still the ocean, and there's no cup that's going to contain him. And what we have to be careful about is we get so focused on the cup that we're holding of understanding, and we've got the water kind of sitting still in that cup, and it kind of makes sense, and we start turning our back on the ocean because we've got something here that we can understand, that we can hold, and it makes sense, and it's complete. And there's a couple of things that may not make sense, but by and large, we got it. And the more we turn our back on the ocean to face the cup that we understand, the more we worship the cup and the less we worship the ocean. And that is the risk of being elite. And we talked about God not favoring the elite last week. All through Scripture, we see examples of the elite, the people with all the knowledge and power and wealth, the people who should have been. If you were picking someone to be on your side, you would pick these people, but God didn't. He would pick the people that weren't that. Because the elite tend to hold on to cups a little too tightly. The Pharisees were the good guys we talked about. They were trying really hard to keep Israel pure, to maintain some sense of identity of the people of God, but they got so focused on the cup, they lost sight of the ocean. And then the challenging piece is that we have to remember that we are the elite, just by about any definition. Education, wealth, power, that is who we are. So we especially have to be very careful. And the two warning signs that we talked about were, one, when you start to feel either arrogantly or just quietly in the back of your head that you never tell anyone about, that, hey, I've got most of this figured out. When we start to feel like we have the answers, and there's only a couple things we don't understand, but mostly we've got it, then we're in danger of being Pharisee elite. That is there's one more thing I was going to say there, but it slipped my mind, so we're going to go past it. That's a sign of not being elite, by the way. When you forget what you're going to say in front of a large group of people, that just reminds you again that you're an introvert, which is a healthy thing to remember when you're standing up in front of a group. Well, I think the right answer there is, and we talked only briefly about this last week, is it is part of how we're wired to seek understanding. Our brains are always working to connect the dots. And the thing that we have to keep in mind, I think part of it is humility, but the right response to some new revelation, new knowledge, is awe and wonder. Awe and wonder gives you a sense of place compared to God. And it, you know, that we talked a little bit about my sciencey background and how when I first encountered relativity, my mind exploded. And that happens with all of us on different subjects. The world gets really big all of a sudden. The right response, the humble response, is awe and wonder. The thing where you get out of kilter a little bit is when you start comparing yourself and your sense of understanding to the people around you. And I think that's the easy, slippery slope, which I hate that phrase, but it really applies here, that we fall into when we learn something new, when we gain some new understanding. Does that sound reasonable to you, John?
Yeah, because I think you can be and have this understanding maybe more than those, but still be humble about it. Mm-hmm. Still
view
the ocean
in awe. I do. I think there's hope for us. If we're the elite, there has to be some hope for us. And I think that's the key.
And God engages.
Yes.
And Jesus certainly chided the Pharisees because they had revelation that they were ignoring, that they had their process on the wrong syllable.
Right.
They were neglecting what the prophets had always excoriated the elites about, which was setting up systems that would expropriate people. People's God-given rights away, mm-hmm. Or look the other way while that was happening. Mm-hmm. And that's where Jesus came down on, not because he was giving some new knowledge about what was right and wrong in that regard.
Right.
So the danger is in drawing the parallels too tightly between, you know, going from one level of scientific knowledge to another, and going from one level of biblical knowledge to some perceived in the latter day that is
contrary. Yeah.
Something that's.
Yeah. I think the true point that I would really jump in there with you is that God is, I think, always trying to hand us a bigger cup than the one we're holding and trying to help us understand Him better and understand His will for us more deeply. And sometimes we're holding on to the old cup so tightly that we can't let it go. And like Saul of Tarsus, He has to knock it out of our hands to hand us the bigger cup. I agree. So, we did not talk last week about, well, what then is the true story of the model between science and faith throughout history? And we're not going to talk about that this week either. This week, we're going to deal with another story that we get wrong for the same reasons we got the Columbus story wrong. We're going to talk about Galileo. Now, the Galileo story, let me summarize for a second what I think we all think we know. And you can shake your head or nod your head as you agree or disagree. But the story we know about Galileo is that Galileo was a scientist. And Galileo essentially proved that the Copernicus's model, that the Earth was not the center of the universe, that heliocentrism was true, the sun was the center, and that the earth moves. And for proving this, the church tortured him and threw him in prison, and he died in prison. That is essentially, I think, the story that we know about Galileo. Well, most of that is wrong. The truth is what we'll talk about today. The truth as best we can know it, I guess. But before we do that, there are a couple of background pieces that we need to talk about. The first is this guy named Copernicus. Copernicus published a book, let me find in my notes, in 1543. And the book was called On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres. And it took him 30 years to do the research for this book. And in this book, he proposed heliocentrism, which is that everything revolves around the sun instead of the earth. And geokineticism, which is that the earth moves. It's one of those things that revolves around the sun. Which overturned the systems that had been in place for almost 2,000 years that had been developed by Ptolemy and Aristotle. Well, Copernicus was, I believe, if I looked at this correctly, a Pole. He was in Poland. Interestingly, he was a canon in the church in Krakow, which is kind of like a administrator, I guess, a business manager. Does that sound, those of you who know more about the Catholic Church, is that right? Is that what a canon does? Whether or not, he was a church guy. Say it again.
Keeper of documents.
Okay. So he wrote this book. How was the book received? Well, other scientists, and we'll come back to that word in a minute, other scientists pretty much rejected it. And the reasons they rejected it were several, and they were good reasons. First, it violated common sense. We don't feel the earth move. If we were traveling around something, we should be able to feel it. It threw out the 2,000 years of theory that had gone before. It subverted physics. The view they had of the way things worked then was that everything revolved around the earth because the earth was the densest, heaviest stuff. And therefore, when something fell, it went from wherever it was down to the center of the earth. Well, if the sun is the center, then why, when you drop a rock, does it not go towards the sun? You know, this didn't make sense to them. The heaviest stuff should fall to the center. If it falls towards the earth, then the earth is the center. There was also this implication of, let me move forward here, stellar parallax, which means if the earth is moving around the sun, we should see the stars shift in the sky as we move, because stuff that is closer moves differently than stuff that's farther away. And you can see some of that if you can see well enough up here. This may not be bright enough. But you've seen images of, like, if you're like me and a science fiction geek, you know, when a starship is going through space, the stars are coming at different rates, and they move in relation to each other. Well, other scientists said you should be able to see that. And in reality, that does happen, but the instrumentation they had at that time couldn't detect it. So the fact that they couldn't detect it made them think, well, it doesn't happen, so this isn't a real view of how things are. And then the final thing that was their objection was that it contradicted Scripture. Specifically, this passage in Joshua. Joshua 10, on the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "Sun, stand still over Gibeon, and you, moon, over the valley of Aijalon." So the sun stood still and the moon stopped till the nation avenged itself on its enemies, as it is written in the book of Jashar. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day. Well, that seems to clearly say to these scientists that the sun is what moves, not the earth. So on scriptural grounds, they rejected it as well. So that was Copernicus, and that's a necessary background piece. Another background piece, and I need to speed up a little bit. Another background piece is less than 100 years before the time of Galileo, there was a very significant event in Christian history, and that was Martin Luther's, I'm trying to think of the right word, revolution, essentially, I guess, works. But the Reformation, the rebellion against all these abuses that happened in Catholicism and the start of Protestantism. Well, before Galileo did his work, there was this Catholic Council of Trent. And they met for 16 years, and they worked on a few things. They worked on clarifying good Catholic doctrine and practice, and they addressed some of the abuses that the Protestants had brought up. But one of the continuing problems they had with, and this is that council, one of the continuing problems they had with the Reformation was this idea that you don't need a priest to interpret Scripture for you, that anyone is free to interpret Scripture for themselves. And the unfortunate side effect of that was that there were some horrible translations of Scripture that were coming out. Just horrible. And we can identify with that. We can think of people in our time who have taken the Bible and done some pretty horrible things with translating it. David Koresh in Waco a few years ago. And in this year, the people who took their interpretation of the Bible to say, we know exactly when the world's going to end. And originally it was May 21st, and now it's been changed to October 21st or 22nd. But, again, it's ignoring all this long history of proper interpretation and building these crazy, to them, interpretations of Scripture. So the Council of Trent basically said, there can be no more crazy interpretations of Scripture. We can give you this, reformers, but we can't give you that. No more. So, Galileo comes on the scene with that background. At first, Galileo was not a convert to Copernicanism. He believed the earth was the center at first. But then, through his work with the telescope, seeing the phases of Venus, and seeing the moons around Jupiter, he came to believe that heliocentrism was the true model. He had students, and one of his students, Mr. Castelli, was at a breakfast with Galileo's employer, or actually the mother of Galileo's employer. Galileo was from the city of Florence, and his employer was a name that some of you or maybe all of you would recognize, the de' Medici family. And this was the mother, what was her name? Christina. So Castelli was at a breakfast with Christina. And Christina said, so Castelli, doesn't Copernicanism conflict with the Joshua passage? Castelli gave her the best answer that he could, and then went back and told Galileo that she'd asked the question. And since she was the mother of his boss, he felt like he needed to provide an answer. So Galileo wrote a letter to Christina. In it, he said a few things that are important. He said, first, Scripture has to be interpreted in light of scientific knowledge. Now, we're going to talk about this more next week. This sounds a little strange to us, but what he's saying is something that is a principle of Augustine's, which is that God wrote the book of Scripture and God wrote the book of nature. And it's a lot of work to interpret each. And we have to be careful in interpreting each. But they never conflict with each other. And if there is an apparent conflict between them, then it means our understanding needs to change of one or the other. So, Galileo was saying, when something is proven in science, then we need to examine our interpretation of Scripture if they seem to conflict. He also said that Scripture was accommodated to the original audiences. And by that, he means something that I was taught at Harding in Principles of Biblical Interpretation, which is that a passage in the Scripture can't mean something different now than it meant to the original audience. So if you want to understand what the Bible is saying, one of the tasks that you have to undertake is to understand what it meant to the audience that it was written to originally. And once you can understand that as best you can, then new insight can come to you for you. But it can't mean the opposite of what it meant originally. It's done in the language of the people that it was written to. So he was saying, by that he meant, if God's saying the sun rises and the sun stopped, he's just speaking based on the understanding of the people of that time who had no clue and would have no context for understanding that the earth moves around the sun instead of the other way around. Now, this is still something today we talk about, and eminent scientists talk about the sun rising and the sun setting, although every one of us knows that's not what's really happening. The earth is spinning, and we're going around the sun. But he's saying God is just speaking in a language that they can understand by saying the sun stopped. He goes on to quote a cardinal, Bologna, "The Bible is to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go." And then finally, he steps into the danger zone a little bit and attempts to reinterpret the Joshua passage himself. Now, reinterpreting Scripture is something that is a real issue right now for the reasons we talked about just a minute ago. The Catholic Church is really worried about these crazy interpretations that are coming up. And Galileo is stepping out and doing one in a letter to someone who's prominent. All right. So that was in the year 1613. In the year 1614, and let's get Castelli up there. In the year 1614, there was a sermon preached in Florence on the Joshua passage, and it was preached by a friar named Caccini. I couldn't find Caccini's picture, but we'll use this for him. Caccini Feldman. What hump? In this sermon, Caccini criticized Copernicanism, all mathematicians, which would include me, and Galileo. It was more than criticizing. It was one of those fire and brimstone sermons. When he was finished, apparently the congregation was outraged, and the next Sunday someone else preached a sermon against what Caccini had said, and Caccini's boss wrote a letter of apology to Galileo. But what caused him to do that in the first place? Well, a year later, in 1615, and this is where we start to get to the story that we know. We may have to do this over 2 weeks. Another Dominican, Niccolo Lorini, and I don't have his picture either, but we'll use Tim Tebow to fill in for him, wrote a letter of complaint to the Inquisition. In this letter of complaint, he included a copy of Galileo's letter to Christina, Galileo's boss's mother. And he said that the letter contained suspect ideas. Well, let's talk for just a second about the Inquisition. When you say the word Inquisition, we all immediately get a picture of torture, you know, putting people in a rack, stretching them, you know, the Inquisition was all bad. Well, at this time, in this place, the Inquisition was probably more like our trial system. They cared a lot about due process. They kept great records. They were orderly, and they wanted to get at what really happened. So fortunately for us, for history, and for Galileo to a certain degree, the Inquisition was more orderly than what we picture in our minds when we say Inquisition. The Inquisition looked at Galileo's letter and said, there are some bad expressions there, but nothing that they're really alarmed about. But what they found as they dug a little bit was that two of the three so-called bad expressions in Galileo's letter weren't actually in Galileo's original letter. They were in the letter that Lorini brought to them. So it made them think, okay, something more is going on here. So they decided to dig a little deeper. And they started calling witnesses. So they called Lorini's friend Caccini, the guy who preached the sermon against Copernicanism, Galileo, and mathematicians just a little earlier. And Caccini testified that Galileo and his followers hold seriously heretical views. And these views are that God weeps and laughs, and that the miracles of the saints are not true miracles. Well, this got the Inquisition's attention really quickly, because that was a much worse crime than the other things that they had mentioned about Galileo. So they started calling Galileo students. One of those students was a man named Adavanti, which I don't even attempt to have a picture of him. But they asked him, do you hold these views? Does Galileo hold these views? And Adavanti said, no. And they said, well, where did this come from? And he said, well, someone may have been eavesdropping on a disputation we were practicing. I didn't know what a disputation was, or if I did know, I'd long forgotten it. But someone here, correct me if I'm wrong, a disputation is a practice where someone starts with an idea and they treat it as if it's true before they tear it down. So it's a way of dealing with something that you disagree with by first talking about it as if it's true. He said, Adavanti said, we were practicing a disputation on some of these ideas, and I guess someone was eavesdropping. And the Inquisition said, well, why do you think someone was eavesdropping on that? And he said, well, we were talking about earlier the ideas of Copernicus, and while we were talking about it, this friar burst in on us and started yelling at us and talking about how it was all wrong, and he vowed to preach a sermon about it. Well, that friar was Caccini, and the sermon that he preached was the one we talked about earlier from 2 years ago. So, okay, the Inquisition's saying, I think we're getting this now. Caccini had been lurking outside, hearing parts of the story, and made up some things. So, the Inquisition essentially dismissed the case against Galileo, except for one piece. They said that we don't have the expertise to judge whether heliocentrism is true or not. So what they did was they hired a consultant. And the consultant went off and for several weeks or months did research and came back and made a recommendation. And the recommendation was that Copernicanism is foolish science and it's heretical in theology, which is a pretty serious set of charges. But again, the Inquisition ignored the report. All the Inquisition did in the end was have a man named Cardinal Bellarmino give a warning to Galileo. And the warning was, don't talk about heliocentrism as if it is anything more than hypothetical. Because, talk about that again in a second. Let me catch up with myself and my slides here. This is, that's not Bellarmino, but this is. So, Bellarmino was a cardinal. He was part of the Inquisition. And what he believed and said to Galileo was, if it's demonstrated that the earth moves around the sun, at that time, we'll reinterpret Scripture. But before we get there, we're not going to. So we treat this as a hypothetical. There's another background piece that I should say, and I'm gonna stop after this and let you all respond, and we'll continue it next week. But those who worked in science in those days, there were two ways that they thought about things. By and large, up until this point, the dominant view was that mathematical models were instruments. The two views were instrumentalism and realism. And instrumentalism was, if I view the heavens and can construct a model that describes the heavens, that's an abstraction. It's a creation of man. It helps me predict where the planets go, but it's not tied to any reality about what makes the planets do what they do. It's an instrument, just like my telescope is an instrument, just like a map that I draw is an instrument. It's separate from reality. Well, and therefore, it's useful for predicting things, but it doesn't tell me anything about how they work. Realism, which just started emerging at this time, was the view that mathematical models do give us insight into how things really work. And realism is the model that we all have today. Realism is what led us to understand antimatter, because there was a mathematical model of how an electron works, and there was this strange little result sitting out here. And I can't remember the guy's name. It was in the 1930s, I believe. He said, I can either treat this as extraneous, but I really think it means there's antimatter. So because the math showed something, and our view now is realism, that math does describe what's really happening, they went looking for antimatter and they found it. Well, in Galileo's day, that was just starting to emerge. Most people held the instrumentalist view. So when Bellarmino said, treat this hypothetically, he was just saying, let's continue to use this to predict what the planets are doing, but let's not presume yet that it really describes how things work. And he had all kinds of rational, honest reasons for saying that. So, Bellarmino gave his warning to Galileo. Galileo asked for a certificate showing what Bellarmino had said and not said, wasn't arrested, wasn't condemned, didn't have to recant anything, just told not to teach it as if it's true. And then Galileo went home to Florence and was there for 7 years. The Pope at that time, Pope Paul V, said to Galileo, you have nothing to fear as long as I'm alive. The unfortunate thing is that Pope Paul V died 7 years later, and Galileo was still alive. But we'll talk about that next week. So stopping there for just a minute, interested in your responses and thoughts and additions. If any.
Successfully be lived by without, you know, the world ending as we knew it. But I generally speaking, as I grew up, my idea was, you know, Catholics are not serious about spirituality. So, you know, that's one of the little subtexts of the story that's kind of interesting. The other, I thought, is in the whole Galileo incident, is probably more in line with the way that occurred. It was sort of like a Senate subcommittee, and it's not that they're necessarily being friendly to the witness, but there are certain rules and protocols that have to be followed, and certain, and in most cases, that was in fact, well, that was in most senses the way that the church went about doing it.
Yeah. I mean, Galileo was a friend of all these people.
Exactly.
To some degree. He was a churchman. He knew the Pope.
Yeah.
I mean, he was as much an insider and stayed in a palace while he was there. He was not poorly treated or disrespected as part of this process.
Usually when Inquisition got off the rails, it was because...
we'll talk about that some next week. The other thing I didn't say, which, and Shannon, you're going to say something, and just give me just a second. Galileo did think he had proofs for the Earth moving around the sun. They were the phases of Venus, but that doesn't necessarily prove anything because Venus and Mercury could go around the sun and that system could go around the Earth and you would still have phases of Venus. He talked about the satellites of Jupiter. And then his most convincing proof to himself was that the Earth's tides were caused by the Earth's motion. Well, that's just completely wrong. The Earth's tides are caused by the moon. And if the Earth moving caused the sloshing of the water, well, we've experienced sloshing of water recently, and it's called a tsunami, and there's a big shaking that happens before it comes. If that were the cause of the tides, twice a day we would all be doing this before we felt the slosh. So his proofs weren't convincing, and Bellarmino was saying, when we have convincing proof, we'll move forward with this, but not until then. Shannon, what were you going to say? Yeah. I come back to myself the idea of the cup. And it's true of my own understanding, but it's also true, I think, of understanding other people's understanding. And it is, man, that's a great insight. I'm not going to swallow it whole yet. The things like what we were taught about science and faith going back, that's such a fundamental fabric of everything that we were taught that it was never expressed that way and we weren't able to reject it or accept it. It's just part of who we were. I guess the fortunate thing is that it doesn't risk. There's nothing. It's almost like it's just a big game anyway because it doesn't risk anything fundamental. Our faith doesn't depend on that. So I think it also says a lot of the things that we think we know right now, 100 years, aren't going to be considered true anymore. So. I didn't see that.
It was an excellent show, but it was just talking about how he was taking the insights of the Reformation and trying to bring them back and expand his Catholic view of them. He and another group of larger group of people. But it sounds like that he and Galileo were both kind of about the same time and doing the same thing. And they were trying to take this earth-shattering event of the Reformation and say maybe we need to rethink some things. And I just really appreciate that they were really thoughtful people in that environment and that didn't have a closed system, that were willing to look at new information and new thoughts. And the whole idea of the PBS thing was that Michelangelo kind of got out a little too far out of the box and kind of had to kind of be brought back in a little bit by his employer, who was the Catholic Church. But even in that, in St. Peter's, he does some sculptures where the people he's portraying, Moses and others, do not look at the center of St. Peter's, but look askew toward where God really is, and not toward the center of this organizational Catholic Church. And he does that in kind of revolution and rebellion to the general thought of things. Anyway, it was very interesting.
Yep. It's 5 till. I need to wrap up. So we'll pick this up next week. But thank you all for helping.